That's right. We are back with episode 493 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I just want to remind everybody that the dog always counts.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and oh my gosh, we get to talk about more comic book stuff. It's a dream come true. Gosh, after all these years of all these other dramas out there, to be able to talk about comic books, even if I'm not thrilled with it, we're still happy.
And this is Ron Slum from Australia, and what do you know? Joss Whedon show, Slicky Dress.
Yeah, I'm not going to complain about that at all. Anyhow, we are going to continue with our discussions of the last couple weeks' worth of episodes and conclude this week's worth of news. But first, before we do any of that, Edmund, if you could please.
Absolutely. Just need to warn you all that we will talk about things that, if you haven't been keeping up, you might not have heard yet. Yes, you will be spoiled, but we always try and leave a week or so for you to find out all this stuff before we do that.
That's right. And, well, as I promised, we're going to go ahead and start with some news. And I believe that, talking about comic books, Gary, why don't you take the first one?
Yes, sir. Holy attrition, Batman. Fox orders a full season of Gotham. Now, I was a little surprised. I'm still not quite sold enough that they would have ordered a full season. They went from the original 16 episodes, which was a full pre-order to begin with, which was pretty confident in this show, and they've now bumped it out to a full 22. I don't know if the writers are scrambling for film material as we speak, or they're going to start a new arc of some sort. I can hope they do, but it would seem coming this late in production that they're going to have to scramble to squeeze in another six episodes into their production schedule.
Yeah, maybe. That's one concern. What I find very interesting here is that even the writers of this particular article are pointing out that this is kind of faint praise that's being given to the series, because it's less a matter of the success of Gotham than it is the complete lack of success of anything else on the network right now. They don't have anything else to really rely on. It's their flagship. For better or worse, that and Sleepy Hollow, or their Monday night is kind of their bread and butter right now. So yeah, it's a little bit surprising, but probably not as surprising as it should be. But there we are. Anyone else surprised by this?
Yeah, a little bit. And I think it's the counterpoint that they bring in at the end of the article that makes it most surprising, was that whole fact that after Sleepy Hollow got off to such a crackerjack start last year, that they just kept that to the ordered 13, but then ordered a bigger second season. So it's kind of odd that last year they were the show that was actually getting much more praise than Gotham has been so far. They didn't feel like adding on. So the rationale seems a little skewed there.
From what I understand, the deal here is more that Sleepy Hollow, they gave the producers the option, mm-hmm. and the producers did not want to have to try to stuff those extra episodes in.
And no, they've been from the get-go, the people making Sleepy Hollow have apparently been taking a leaf out of Hannibal's book, apparently. Like, they want to stick to a cable model in terms of number of episodes and whatnot. Like, they want to, they would rather have a short run and pack in the story.
Right, exactly. So they were given the option, but they basically said, thanks, no thanks. We want to just give us a second season right away. And that's why they got that really ridiculously early second season pickup, was because they were going to get the rest of the season, per se. And they were saying, well, no, that's not what we want. Which is kind of nice on their end.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Of course, the fact that the Gotham's producers weren't feeling like that now gets me even more worried.
Yeah, you know what? This show doesn't really strike me as the kind of show that has that level of forethought behind it.
Yes.
It feels more episodic. Yeah. So I'm not surprised by that all that much. Let's see. Moving on then to the next article here. Edmund, why don't you take this one?
Certainly. And this is taking us back to the Marvel Universe. And apparently Robert Downey Jr. is on the verge of signing on to Captain America 3. with apparently because Iron Man is going to come into the Captain America films to kick off the Civil War storyline from the comic books. So.
Yeah, so this gets back to that earlier article about the rumors about Avengers 3, and now it maybe makes a little bit more sense. If the Captain America 3 is really sounding more like a kind of like Avengers 3 part 1, which would then lead into perhaps Avengers 3 being the follow-up to Captain America 3. Not unlike what happened with Captain America the Winter Soldier, more or less being the prelude to the second season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and also leading somewhat into Avengers 2. Although there's a lot of argument to say that Iron Man 3 also is a direct prequel or lead into that as well. But the idea here is that the big picture is maybe forming a little bit here around what the Phase 3 is going to turn into, which is coming out of Age of Ultron. Is there going to be some kind of rationale for the tension between Tony Stark and Steve Rogers erupting in the films afterward?
Oh, even just when I first read this article, which was way back when it was a few days ago when it was first posted, my immediate thought is, like, I just started writing through my head and was like, everything that's happened and everything that I know about what's happening in upcoming Marvel movies, this makes perfect sense. Because on one hand, you've got Captain America 2, which establishes that Cap is Cap would rather go against the authorities to protect freedoms and liberties and stuff like that, if that's what it took. Whereas what's been officially released about Age of Ultron is that the whole bad situation, I think it's safe to say, in that movie is going to come about because of Tony Stark and his attempts to is to take a lot of the superheroism, saving the world, keeping people safe, stuff like that, take that into his own hands. And I can see that really setting up Tony Stark coming out of that movie with this mindset of, right, guys like us can't be trusted. him coming away with the thing of just like, you know what, a government oversight sort of thing, whatever, just like might actually be what we need.
And if you look at the Tony Stark character arc, where he used to be essentially against that kind of thing, it would take something really big for him to conclude otherwise. Like you said,
like
when you
look Ultron.
When you see all of these pieces come together the way that they are, at least in the big picture, not maybe the details, the finer details, it's just very exciting to me that it really speaks to me that they've been seeding these films with a lot of potentials. And just the fact that they're talking about the people behind Winter Soldier kind of becoming the heirs apparent to Joss Whedon when it comes to overseeing the direction of the films. I think that would be perfectly fine because it's clear to me that, like you said, they've been planting the seeds for a very long time in a lot of this stuff, but in such a way that if it doesn't come about, you don't lose anything because it's authentic for what it is. So I'm just excited because all these different rumors are all adding up very logically, like you said. It all fits a scheme, a tapestry that has been in the planning for a while. And it definitely speaks to the strength of the Marvel film franchise right now. Let's see. Moving on then to the next one. Gary, why don't you take this next one, too? I think that actually, I remember you talking about this when it first was published.
Yeah, I thought it seemed familiar, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it, and I believe you're right. One second. Okay, we're talking about... Oh, yes, I do. Okay. We're talking about this. Sci-Fi acquires a new drama series called Dark Matter from the writer of Stargate. This was a comic book series, and I guess everybody's going to the comic book well nowadays, about a group of people who wake up in a spaceship, and they have no memories of who they are or how they got on board the ship, and now all of a sudden they have to work together and try and get to someplace safe and find out where the spaceship was meant to go. It's sort of not really a Robinson Crusoe, but it's this sort of, they're stuck and they have to interact with each other. They can't leave the ship. They have to work together. So I'm really looking forward to it. It was a good comic book series, and I don't want to give anything away with where things went, but I sort of like that idea. It's a lot of tension moments, as well as some nice ones along the way. But it's these people who are trapped somewhere, and they have to work together, or everybody dies. So it's I like the premise, especially set on on a spaceship in the future. So we'll see where it goes. It's I would say it's always had a dark taste to it, like a sort of a ominous about the whole situation. So I think they can pull it off, and hopefully well.
Yeah, it definitely, I vaguely recall it. It was a relatively short series, but it had a lot of potential to it. And I'm guessing this is, I always wondered what happened to it. I'm guessing this is it then. This is what happened. It was getting prepped for a different type of media expansion.
Well, the guy had talked about it at the time. He couldn't get anywhere with the storyline, so he published it as a comic book. Because if I recall correctly, he had tried to, not hard, but he sort of, was feeling it around, and nobody wanted to bite on it, so he ended up doing it as a comic book.
Hey, there you go, right? Okay, this next article is something that I think everybody was expecting to happen sooner or later, and here we are. HBO is launching its own standalone streaming service next year.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, the first crack.
Well, in some ways they have it already. I mean, they have the product; it works, it exists. It's just tied to your cable subscription, but it can't take much to cut that. So, I mean,
no.
I'm surprised, honestly, how forthcoming cable companies have been about allowing HBO to do it. Honestly, because they have, for all intents and purposes, a finished product. Once you get the billing's not hard to get out of the way. So.
Already I've heard, and it was more of a rumor, which is why I didn't link to the article, but CBS is also now thinking of doing something exactly the same.
Yeah, I think that has actually been announced now. So.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. See, that's why I said the cracks are now widening in the cable monopoly,
mm-hmm.
because now it's almost, before it was cutting the cable, but maybe with, having to lose things in the process. Now, no, not even that. So... yeah, it's interesting. This is going to change some things.
Some things? It's going to change everything. As much as cable companies like Comcast invested isn't even a fair enough term, have transformed themselves into media companies to try and survive what's going to end up them becoming sort of just data providers. Not even, you're not going to need cable per se to get those 113 channels for, $80 a month that they're promising you anymore. You're just going to have a pipe. And I wonder how things like this not only are going to affect how we get shows, but also from the data side of what costs and changes are going to happen to data as you're starting to pull down significantly more information over, down through your Ethernet connection. Full HD for every show you watch through a data connection is served a lot differently than through cable lines.
Yeah, absolutely. The devil is going to be in the details. I mean, yes, HBO has HBO Go, where you have this amazing access to virtually everything that they've produced. But the question is going to be is the standalone service going to be that, or is it going to be something more limited, which is what I suspect, at least initially, to as kind of the sop to the cable companies. But I also don't find it surprising that it's HBO and CBS who are essentially the top cable and top network. At the providers at the moment, who are the ones who are opening that door a crack initially.
Mm. Now, we've talked a lot about the Marvel Universe and how cohesive it is. Gary, here's something about DC's response from the movie side.
Holy heck, you're not kidding. This took me by surprise, honestly. DC has often talked about sort of, coming back, or they're going to address the whole ongoing movie issue in their own way and at their own time, and I guess this was now the time that they're going to do it. They announced a whole slew of movies, everything from the promised standalone Wonder Woman movie through smaller things such as Suicide Squad, which people who are familiar with Arrow have a taste of what it is. Oddly, we're getting a Flash movie with a different actor than the television series, which surprised me that they're going to the well twice with the same character.
They announced a little bit ago, because since the talk of the DC cinematic universe has been ramping up, one of the questions going around has been, will they fold Arrow And then later, when the Flash was on, will they fold in the Flash TV show as well? Will they fold those into the movie universes? And it's been a little while since they made the announcement. It's like, no, they're their own thing. We're going to do our own version of Flash and maybe Green Arrow as well in the movies. So, I did see that announcement. I like the actor that they picked for the Flash movie.
I'm not criticizing that, but
it does seem a bit silly that they're not taking the opportunity to kind of do what Marvel's doing, which is essentially like, let's take some of our properties, pursue them on television, you know, with a different department that's got its own budget.
Well, I understand that, but at the same time, you look at a show like S.H.I.E.L.D., and that can easily be at full arm's length away all the time from, you know, even the Avengers, where, you know, having the Flash TV show and then have him in Justice League as well, I think it, you know, sort of weaves things even more so than S.H.I.E.L.D. gets woven into the, you know, Avengers universe. So I'd have to see about that. But, you know, not only that, but they're also going to have a new Green Lantern movie that is not going to be Ryan Reynolds. The character of Cyborg, who's in the current Justice League comic book, was in Teen Titans for a while. Of course, you've heard rumors about, you know, a Shazam movie. We've heard rumors about, you know, Aquaman cast. So there's a lot of different things, you know, besides the Batman Lego movie, if you want to fall that under the DC banner. And just to jump back even to Green Lantern, there's talk right now of which Green Lantern it's going to be. Is it going to be all of the Green Lanterns? Is it going to be, you know, is it going to be the classic Hal Jordan? Is it going to be Jon Stewart? Is it going to even be Guy Gardner? I've heard rumors. So that's wide open too. So they've thrown out this, you know, this sled of movies between 2 to 3 a year for the next 6 years, starting in 2016. So it's quite an ambitious thing, and I hope they can keep it up, honestly. While they're not late to the movies bringing superheroes, in some sense they're late to this latest run of them. So I hope they can keep it up. We'll have to see. I find it hard to believe some of these characters can pull off a whole movie on their own, but on the other hand, so did Guardians of the Galaxy, so we'll have to see.
Yeah, and so they made this announcement. So 2016, Batman versus Superman, of course, Suicide Squad, the first of the three new Harry Potter universe movies with Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them Part 1.
Because that needs to be three movies.
Yes, it does.
Well, if Hobbit could be three movies, anything could be three movies.
Hobbit deserves to be three movies because...
let's table that. Okay,
And then the Lego Ninjago movie, whatever that is. So 2017, Wonder Woman, Justice League, and the Lego Batman movie.
That's going to be awesome.
That is, yeah.
That's going to be so good.
Everything is awesome. Anyway, 2018, The Flash, Aquaman, and the second Fantastic Beasts, and the Lego Movie 2. And I can only assume that the Lego movies are not unlike the Marvel movies and such that the bridge between Lego Movie 1 and 2 will be covered by the other two movies. 2019, Shazam and Justice League 2. And then 2020 is Cyborg, Green Lantern, and the final Fantastic Beast film. But
Fantastic Beasts 3, the search for more beasts, because we didn't find any of the first two times.
So 5 years, all these films, yet that's not everything. Because, Gary, the next article.
Oh, yes, and I was waiting. I was surprised this wasn't listed in the sled of movies that they were listing when they rolled these out. Well, if you look at the movie schedule, we've left out some major characters. Well, two specifically. We've left out Batman, and we've left out Superman. They will also be having their own standalone movies, and they will squeeze in somewhere in this 2016 to 2020 time frame that they've put in. They haven't actually earmarked out what year or in what order they will be out, but they are planning to release a standalone Batman and Superman films. And while we might assume that, you know, Cavill and Ben Affleck, I get to mention them in a third episode of this week. Hooray. Anyway, while they are signed, you know, for the Justice League movies, for the first Justice League movie as well, we don't know what's going to happen or if they'll be going forward in Justice League 2 or these standalone movies. We'll have to see.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be very interesting. Edmund, if you could take the final article here.
Absolutely. Lifetime has officially canceled its low-rated drama, The Lottery, after one season.
Oh.
Yes, not to the surprise of any of us who actually watched the show. Yes. Thankfully, the show kind of ends in a definitive enough way that you don't feel cheated in any sense. It was a good premise.
Yeah.
Actually, fairly strong science fiction basis, but it was clearly not a very high budget.
Yes.
Series, to say the least.
Yeah, and some of the plot kind of went off the rails in the last couple of episodes.
Yes, yes, exactly. All right, well, that's it for the news for this week, and so we will be going into our mid-show break, after which we will continue with our episodic discussion, so stay tuned. And I think the last time that we talked, was Bronstone was the last one to do it. So, Edmund, I think that you get the next shot here.
Okay. Well, since unlike the lottery, it did get renewed, why don't we talk about Manhattan?
All right. And we have two episodes here. Let's go ahead and start with the promo for the first one, if that one, in fact, exists.
This isn't the Ivy League. We're in the middle of a war. Every move costs a piece, and this piece tried to rape your wife.
I've been watching you and Helen Prims. I know what you're doing.
I don't gamble.
See, I don't think that's true.
What do you want from me?
Traitors who run atomic programs for our enemies.
Wars have casualties, Abby.
All new Manhattan, Sunday.
Okay, and if you could do the recap, please.
Certainly. Manhattan, Season 1, Episode 11. I believe it's actually Tangier. A development overseas invigorates the hunt for a spy on the Hill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what would you give this one?
I will give this one 8.5.
All right. And Gary, did you catch this one?
Yes, I did. I would give it an 8.
All right. And I would probably give it an 8 as well. Okay, so, Edmund, high level, what did you what were your highlights for this episode? You gave it an 8.5, which is fairly close to your average for the whole season so far.
Well, I liked the way they did circle back to the German spy, and that was certainly for a show that's been concentrating on Los Alamos and just the machinations within the scientists, bringing the Nazis in yes, a bit of an over the top classic World War II movie way, I thought it was a nice change of pace and a nice reminder of exactly why they're doing these things, and why Frank Winter gets himself so bent out of shape at times. Getting back to the hill, it also meant that as a result of the spy's cover being blown, the security gets to clamp down even more, and it was just a nice ramping up of all of the security concerns that they've been building up throughout the season, and then meanwhile, of course, the ongoing intrigue and subterfuge of implosion team, the implosion calculations being farmed out. I continue to like the fact that they've got smart people on both sides as these things are trying to be run, and they do figure things out, and at the same time are still human beings with who can be nasty and arrogant and play things out in ways that may not be completely rational, because you still get emotional about these things, and it's continuing that nice balance for me of remaining relatively true to the scientific nature of things, and at the same time giving us these character dynamics that also feel very, very true to life.
Gary, what would you add to that?
No, Edmund made several good points. The one sort of high point for me of this that he left out was that the character of Tom Lansfield figuring out what Charlie was having him do with these calculations. Mm-hmm. You know, these are all extremely smart men. You know, these are the smartest people we could find in America to send to try and figure this out. So it comes as no surprise that one of these guys would start looking at these numbers and figure out that what they were, you know, calculating was not the project that they were supposed to do. And, you know, not only does he confront him on it, but he says he's basically going to rat him out and get him kicked out of the whole project. And Charlie's fearful of that, not only for himself, but, you know, like all these guys, they think they're the only people that can figure this out, that they're so vitally needed to be there that no one else can do their job. So there's always a bit of that. So he, you know, comes up with this whole idea to plant evidence in the guy's house. Not only in the guy's house, but since every person's house is the same, you know where all the hiding spots are. So you can basically say, okay, go to his house. You know that panel right there? Drop it there. So he tries at first to talk his wife into seducing the guy, but when he sees that quite what isn't going to work, he talks her into, you know, just planting this evidence. And there is some doubt as the way the scene's laid out, whether or not what it's going to really happen. But sure enough, the next morning, you know, the guy's getting carted out by security. All their stuff is, you know, basically getting, you know, they have to grab their stuff and leave the whole camp because they were, you know, found with this. And they did such a good job of laying foundation for what happens to people who hide paperwork. I mean, we had one guy basically commit suicide over that. You know, another guy we saw getting interrogated over the issue. So we know the heavy cost that comes with setting someone up like that. So in a backhanded way, it strikes you even harder because you know what's going to happen to this guy as a result of this happening. And so, you know, it shows the lengths that people will go with, you know, to secure their job and keep secrecy within this program.
Yeah, and the way they had set up the human cast of that as well. I mean, the fact that Charlie's doing that, not knowing that yes, even though Abby has told him about Tom being essentially coming on to her, but not knowing, of course, that she has since been basically carrying on an affair with his wife, and so when her initial reaction is completely to reject the idea of doing it, and then just there's some wonderful scenes, shots of Rachel Brosnahan where you see the wheels sort of slowly turning, and you're not quite sure which direction they're turning until that morning scene when she has decided that she's more concerned about protecting her family rather than running away with her new unconventional lover. I mean, it was just a devastating ending to that episode.
Yeah, definitely a banner episode there. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one, because I don't think it gets any easier for anybody.
No.
You're implicated in a conspiracy to sabotage the most secret project in military history. Right now we have to figure out a way to keep you safe.
You've been listening to Akeley.
I've been listening to reason.
You can't trust him, Charlie.
Oh, but I can trust you.
When the Army and G2 find out about this, they'll be knocking on your door.
I don't believe in keeping secrets anymore.
Did you even know what you were getting involved in?
I framed him, and for what?
Get dressed. We're going for a drive.
All right, Nedmund, if you could.
Yes, this is season 1, episode 12, The Gun Model. Akeley becomes vulnerable when he tries to fix Thin Man's shortcomings.
Oh, boy. Okay, and what would you give this one?
I will give this one a 9.
All right, and how about you, Gary?
Jeez, I hate to duplicate Edmund, but yeah, that's right where I'm at with this episode. It was a really good one.
Yeah, I give it an 8.5, and so pretty close. Gary, why don't you get us started here? What was your highlight for this one?
It seems in a lot of ways like things are coming to a head, that we've had these issues building where Frank is constantly trying to figure out what's going on with Thin Man and doing everything he can to get it to work, and he just finally, it seems like he's a little bit more focused than he was. Just trying to see. I'm trying to keep the two episodes separate in my head. Edmund, if you could start off.
Sure. Well, I mean, the thing with this one was the whole Charlie sort of being this ping pong ball between Akeley and Frank, and the whole ongoing back and forth of the fact that he thinks that that Thin Man's dead because they can't get the plutonium that's pure enough, and Akeley saying, oh well no, that's just because the plant you were at isn't going to produce good enough stuff, but the Washington plant, which we know will be Hanford, is generating that purity, and it becoming this whole back and forth between the two of them. But in the end, again, it's one of those things where I think they're playing brilliantly with the audience expectations for those of us who know that yes, eventually they do get there, when it comes out that Hanford is not necessarily is not yet producing at that level, and this was as much a game of politics, and Akeley feeling that he's got to try and maintain his team and fight for his model by any means necessary, and so it was just the. And certainly the way the way they play with that back and forth dynamic the entire show, and to the point where what makes the ending so devastating is that it really seems like they have finally come to that reconciliation and that meeting of the minds, even though that final gunshot was not a total surprise, you were really hoping that it had been avoided, and then to have it happen was and Akeley to shoot himself in the truck, he just couldn't take the idea of leading a losing team. Again, I mean, the ending of the previous episode was pretty devastating, and this one was as well.
Well, you know, it wasn't only that too. It was the whole, Charlie with his wife, that whole dynamic playing out, and her, getting up to leave as well. That, we had assumed, status quo would go on for the, while everyone was quote stuck at this camp, but no, people still, break up, and she's going to leave. I'm not sure how security wise that ends up working, but, that was a bit of a shock too, and you have to wonder, it makes you think when you think about, Akeley, how people get so wrapped up in their own thing that they don't see, that their idea wasn't working and why he didn't jump on Frank's bandwagon. You think about some of the earlier episodes of this show when they start talking about, how many people are killed every day and that how you have to, move forward with this and figure it out so that we can, stop all these deaths from happening. And but people get wrapped up in their own stuff, and that's sort of what you saw with Akeley. He didn't want to see that his method didn't want to work, or maybe he did finally and couldn't handle it, but for so long he was blocking the other method for implosion. And it just it makes you see the people differently, I think. You see them struggling to show how they have value and worth rather than the actual cause, where I think he got tripped up.
Yep. And also, I mean, the other thing that was going on was with Liza, Frank's wife, jumping into the race for the city council or whatever they were, the town council, camp council, whatever makes sense.
Yeah.
And that whole speech about transparency and security, which was sounding awfully timely. And not because I think they were trying to inject a political current political element. It's that's precisely the issues that they've been dealing with throughout this season. It also makes sense to have her kind of tilt at that windmill a little bit
it goes back to Liza constantly trying to find a purpose.
Yeah.
And, we've gone through, she's tried to do so many different things, and she's either been failed or blocked every time. And so, maybe this is what she needs, to get herself going. I'm thankful that she keeps positively trying stuff. It is sort of a morale booster that even as she's had to deal with her, I guess I'll call it depression, that she keeps pulling out of it. She was trying to do, botany experiments. Those got canceled. She was trying to work with the maternity ward. And then she, saw the radiation start to flip out about that. And now she's, she still keeps trying and trying and trying. And it's a nice thing. I can't say I feel positive about it, but she won't give up. So, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, that's true. Let's see. I don't have anything really to add to either one of these. I think this series is going along very well, and I was happy to see that it was renewed. Let's see. I think we've got some time here. Bronstam, what would you like to add to our slate here?
Since I brought it up, might as well talk about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Sounds good to me. Two episodes that we have here. Let's start with the first one. Here's the promo.
Are you ready to comply? Tuesday.
I'm getting tired of losing our best and brightest to Hydra.
For the bad guys.
No one leaves here alive.
It's recruitment time.
I'm well aware of who I work for.
And top of their list are the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
What side did you end up on?
Did you think I wouldn't find out?
New Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Next Tuesday at 9, 8 central. And see the season from the beginning on Watch ABC and ABC On Demand.
And if you could do the recap, please.
I can probably handle that. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 2, Episode 3, Making Friends and Influencing People. A team member is caught in the middle as Coulson and the agents try to reach a man with dangerous freezing powers before Hydra does.
Mm-hmm. All right, and what would you give this one?
I give this one an 8.
All right, and how about you, Gary?
I'll give it an 8.5.
All right, and Edmund, how about you?
I'll go with an 8.
All right, and I just need to check on what I gave this one, because I don't remember off the top of my head, but my review over at VogNetwork.com, I, in fact, gave it an 8.5. So there you go. We were all pretty consistent here, but Bronstone, get me started. What was your maybe your highlight for this episode?
They didn't waste any time about sort of resolving the question of what happened to what had happened to Simmons between season one and season two. I mean, they made a surprise twist at the end of the first episode that she wasn't really around, and you know, sort of talked around it. And so I'm glad that we got to it very, very quickly. I don't think they ever really tried to hide the idea that she was a what do we call it? That she was a, you know, SHIELD spy within Hydra.
Yeah.
Why did I blank on that word? They just sort of, you know, rolled straight into it. They had Herbie front and center for the majority of the episode. I thought it was a great, it was a good way to focus, a good way to do something different from what they'd done in the previous episode, and it moved along. It moved along some of the ongoing story in this season, which is the placing greater emphasis on SHIELD versus Hydra, both of them being very underground and very Hydra, I suppose, being the more dangerous in this situation because they seem to have more resources and whatnot. But that just means that the good guys are, they're the underdogs. It reinforces, you know, why we should like them and whatnot. Bringing back Donnie from the first season was a smart play. Rather just introduce some brand new, you know, gifted person with powers and stuff like that. I thought they're handling the ongoing story really, really well. They're finding cool, you know, interesting, good, cool things to do with the characters. And episode was very solid. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. One of the things that I liked, I think that you were kind of alluding to there, was that this episode made a lot of the similarities between the new SHIELD and the, you know, longstanding Hydra that had been hiding within the old SHIELD. Both of them are kind of treating Donnie Gill as a bit of an object to be won rather than as a person. And that was kind of interesting to see because, of course, philosophically, they don't agree with each other at all. Yet, as far as methods go and certain attitudes, they're very similar. The other thing that I liked is that Simmons last season, almost infamously in the episode where they were at the hub, was a complete and utter mess when it came to lying and infiltrating. She did a lot better this time, and it shows character growth, which is something that I think has been the strength of the show since the big turn after Winter Soldier. So, yeah, I was very happy with it on those levels. Gary, what would you add to this?
Well, yeah, again, I'll echo Simmons was a really good choice. As you look at our team, she does make the most sense to go undercover. You know, of course, Coulson can't, even May can't. Fitz can, he's damaged property, and Sky, I don't know if she could pull it off, or at least not long term. So, you know, Simmons made a lot of sense, but you know, and I have to question how a secret organization like Hydra already has like badges with the Hydra logo on all their
equipment. Yeah,
that struck me
as a bit funny too.
Internal branding is extremely important.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, well, you know, we do have to build our secret base and remain hidden from the government, from SHIELD and stuff like that, but like, we're totally getting jackets, right? Oh, yeah, we're getting jackets.
Yeah. And, you know, but it brought another thing to mind, and I wish they would address it somehow, and maybe they haven't. I've missed it. You guys can explain it to me. Hydra seems to have so many bases every time Coulson pulls up a schematic. They have so many people and so many resources, and here he's, you know, he's got one small base with a not even a skeleton crew worth of people, yet was SHIELD that infiltrated to, you know, that like 75-80% of them were Hydra?
I think part of it is the notion that what happened in the last third of season one was that you essentially had what's left of SHIELD and what's left of Hydra running around trying to grab up as many resources as they could. Hydra, I think it was, they also suggested that it was like there are Hydra people who weren't necessarily in SHIELD. Like, they had been recruiting outside, like, you know, people who were in, people who are in government, maybe people who are in, armed services, and probably just outside people. Mm-hmm. So their personnel just sort of, like, moved in to fill the gap.
I know, it just seemed like they're, out of all the SHIELD, like, Coulson would be able to call on, like, 100 people. you know, not a huge number by any means, but certainly more than his ragtag, dozen that he's dealing with right now.
Well, I was going to say the last thing is that the last third of season one wasn't about Coulson and his people dealing with Hydra. It was about them dealing with Garrett specifically. And at the same time as they're sort of trying to deal with the government. So I think, I don't know, and again, this is me, you know, sort of doing my best to read into it, which is not necessarily a good thing. But I get the impression that basically, like, while Coulson and what's left of S.H.I.E.L.D. were dealing with, had more problems to deal with, Hydra had a relatively free rein to sort of gather its resources and get its ducks in a row.
Yeah, that was kind of my impression as well, was that they were that, well, Coulson and his team are just, they're back on their heels still, where Hydra was basically running the show in secret. They had a lot more going on.
Oh, no, I understand. It's just the bare bones level that he's at just seems a bit much, as we look at the previous episode where they had to, you know, risk so much just to get, you know, one Quinjet versus, you know, you'd think there were some more resources than there are, but that's just, that might be a nitpick of mine. The nice thing about this, one of the nice things about this episode was Fitz finally confronting, Ward at the booth and, you know, letting, you know, pouring out his heart, telling, you know, what he did to them. And then you listen to Ward, you know, trying to say, like, I was trying to give you a fighting chance. They just wanted me to shoot you dead. You know, and so, you know, Ward, you know, he can be awfully convincing, too. You really want to sort of see his side to some extent, which is, you know, good writing and acting. But, you know, it's, you know, when Fritz was, you know, sucking the oxygen out of the tank, I was like, wow, you know, you really sort of sensed how this had affected Fritz. You knew about Fitz. You knew about his frustrations over not being as, you know, having the brain damage and stuff like that. But it was nice to actually see him sort of pour his heart open by torturing Ward.
It just makes me think back to a year ago when the show was a few episodes in and people were talking about the fact that characters like, you know, Ward and Skye were way too bland and Fitz and Simmons were just obviously comic relief characters. And yeah, that's changed a bit.
Yeah, just a titch.
Let's see. Let's go ahead then and move on to the next episode, which I think we'll have a lot more to talk about. Here's the promo.
Isn't this fun?
Look, cufflinks.
Next Tuesday, going undercover.
That painting could mean answers for us.
Is a delicate dance.
There goes our cover.
One misstep.
The painting's there.
Could put the whole team at risk.
The plane will explode. We need to go.
Guys, wait, you're about to hit.
Laser grids. Why is it always laser grids?
New Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Next Tuesday at 9, 8 central on ABC.
All right, and Bronstone, if you don't mind.
Sure. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 2, Episode 4, I Will Face My Enemy. Coulson seeks to unlock the mystery of his alien writing and is attacked by a trusted ally. Meanwhile, with the team trapped, Fitz might be their only hope.
Mm-hmm. All right, and what would you give this one?
I'd give this one a 7.
And Gary?
7.5.
All right, and Edmund?
7.5.
All right, and once again, let me go over here and check if there are any reader comments on this one. I gave this one an 8.5.
Now, why did you give this an 8.5?
now this one, I'm for number one, I've been fairly consistent all season, giving the show an 8.5, so that's part of it. But then I think that part of this is difficult for me to quantify without a little bit of bias, because this is the episode I saw at New York Comic Con, surrounded by a good 2,000 to 3,000 other ardent Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. fans.
Ah.
So yes, the good points were greatly heightened by the thrill of the crowd. And let me not forget to mention that I think Agent May is awesome. I think Min Na is awesome, and yeah.
Silver dresses are awesome, yes.
Yeah, silver dresses are almost as good as red dresses on Arrow.
Yes.
That, and I just think that there were implications of this episode that feed very nicely into the pacing of this season. And when the kind of more comedic side of the series is an occasional thing instead of something that they do every single week, it's better for the series as a whole. Because I like the fact that this started in one place and ended up going in a very different place. It started very lighthearted and wound up going kind of dark. particularly in terms of Coulson and his situation. So I just thought that it was good, consistent with what they've been doing so far, and yet at the same time, it was basically saying that all these hints about the alien writing and Coulson's mental state and all of that, it's not going to be something that they just let linger all season long. They're going to address it sooner rather than later, because they kind of have to. But Garrett, or Bronstone, why did you feel this was average? Was it the comedic stuff was a little too much, or what?
I think this episode really, where it succeeded, it was on the back of the dynamic between Coulson and May.
Yes.
That was really fun. But the actual story, I mean, beyond the importance of the MacGuffin, I thought it was kind of hammy. I thought there was no suspense about the possibility of Talbot being a Hydra agent. Like, not for a second did I think that was the case. I thought a couple of those fights looked really badly choreographed. I don't know if that was me, but there've been some good ones on this show before, and then these ones, some of these just seemed very, very rubbish. The you know, May on May action seemed like too obviously fan servicey. It feels like, I don't know, someone got a job on the show on the back of their, you know, Melinda May fanfic or something. And I don't know, yeah, it was, there were just so many things about the episode that were not necessarily, you know, either kind of bad or just very ho-hum. And it was the dynamic between Coulson and May, as well as I thought, the idea of giving Fitz a chance to sort of be more, you know, be the hero and have him, you know, develop a bit more. His hallucination goes away. He's getting a chance to bond with some of the other characters, and you know, in a way that he sort of was with Ward, but obviously in a hopefully more legitimate sense. I thought that was a nice moment too. It was. Too much of the episode was just kind of meh.
Edmund, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, for me, I mean, it was more the body double aspect of it that seemed way too clunky to me, and way too obvious in terms, you know, doing it with Coulson and May, where they have this long history with it within the context of the show itself, and the great chemistry between Clark Gregg and Ming-Na, and so it was one of these situations where it was just too much of a foregone conclusion that, yes, of course they're going to see right through somebody, you know, impersonating May, and even the stuff with Talbot as well. It was that I thought could have been handled a bit better in terms of the moment Coulson starts probing him a little bit, and he's just not acting right, and that just seemed a little too. I'm trying to avoid the word, but comic booky. I thought, especially in the case of Talbot, where it's somebody who they would have had a chance to really actually have more of an opportunity to study and get mannerisms down, that they could have done a better job of making him appear authentic. So that was the part that really kind of just didn't really grab me throughout the whole episode.
Okay. Gary, anything you want to add to this?
Yeah, I think we're leaving out a substantial portion where we see this guy who's, I want to take it as Coulson's analog and runs Hydra, or at least is very high up in it. We're seeing how much more sort of organized, and it really feels like they have a plan going forward, where our guys are kind of scrambling or still trying to gather resources and get a handle on things. You know, this guy has teams in place. He's brainwashing, I guess, agents that he's captured, and maybe that accounts for some of their higher numbers than Coulson's ragtag band. I'm curious if this turns out to be the striker from Captain America history. Did he find out a way to, you know, get young again or something like that? So, you know, that's sort of interesting. But and then he had Reyna at the end?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so, you know, Reyna, who I considered, I guess at this point she was a free agent, all of a sudden she is not so free anymore. He puts, you know, some tech device on her hand, and I don't know how much it will control her, but it's certainly, you know, she was had to listen to him and was in pain as a result of it. So, and now she seems like, you know, he wants her to do his wishes. So, you know, it sort of ramps up and really gives us a actual credible opponent to deal with throughout all this. You know, we had seen, who is it? Taggart? What's it? General? Is it Taggart?
Oh, Talbot.
Talbot. General Talbot. And I was starting to wonder whether he was going to sort of be the, you know, the villain or the adversary, but obviously not. I don't think he's an ally, but, you know, it's definitely this Hydra guy is the enemy. So I'm curious if he's going to be enemy number one for the rest of the season, the series, or where that's going to go. But as John was saying earlier, you know, this episode did open up a lot of directions for where the season will go.
Yeah, and, right. and certainly getting an actor of Reed Diamond's caliber to play him is an indication that, yes, he's I'm pretty sure they're setting him up for a major role.
Yeah, for reference, the character is actually an existing character in the comic book lore called Kraken. So probably not who you're thinking of, Gary. Just off the top of my head, he's not Strucker. He's a completely different character.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Let's see here. I think that we are going to have to go ahead and kind of defer the rest of the main topics for another day. Just to say how packed things are, we're putting aside shows like Haven, Doctor Who, Homeland, Sleepy Hollow, Person of Interest. and yeah, we'll be having to cover them next time. Because I do just want to run through the quick hits just to round out this week. And a couple of these I'm sure you guys will want to comment on. First, I'll just go ahead with The Vampire Diaries, Season 6, Episode 1. I'll Remember. Season 6 begins with Elena returning to Whitmore College for the start of sophomore year. Meanwhile, Caroline becomes desperate to reverse the anti-magic spell the Travelers put over Mystic Falls. Tyler has a run-in at a football tailgate. Matt worries that Jeremy is dealing with the loss of Bonnie in a self-destructive way. Alaric struggles to adjust to his new life as a vampire. And Elena learns the truth about what Stefan has really been up to. I gave this premiere a 6.5. Season 6, Episode 2, Yellow Ledbetter. I don't know what the hell. Anyway, Elena deals with the loss of Damon and turns to Alaric to help her move on with her life. Meanwhile, Enzo gets Caroline to help him find Damon and Bonnie. Jeremy spends time with a mysterious girl who recently arrived in Mystic Falls, and Damon and Bonnie reluctantly band together to uncover the mystery of where they are and how they are going to get back home. I gave this one a 7. Gary and you guys, I think that you'll be interested to know that Colin Ferguson is a member of the cast this year, and he is this really sadistic vampire killer.
Ooh, wow.
Yes, he likes to round them up into his specialized little work van with a retracting ceiling. He chains them up, brings them, you know, into town where they're not supposed to be in the first place so that they suffer, and then opens up the top so that they can be hit by sunlight and burn to death. And he sings along to his radio while this is going on. It's kind of fun.
Charming.
Yes. It's like he took notes from Haven and just kind of decided, oh, I'm gonna double up on this. All right. Gary, I wanted you to have the opportunity to speak to the next topic, if you want to go ahead and give us a rundown here.
How did you know I would be watching it? Probably because I said I was. Anyway, we're talking about, yes, Star Wars Rebels. They started this first season of this new animation project, and it's with a lot of the same old creators and writers, but all the talent as well as the actual style of the animation is different from previous Star Wars films. The first episode was called Spark of the Rebellion. Rebels aboard the starship Ghost battled the evil Galactic Empire when it tries to tighten its powerful grip on the galaxy. Episode one, it really is a pilot. It shows how our group of individuals came together, you know, because of, you know, oppression by the Empire. Go figure. Anyway, it's showing how the rebellion is getting started. It's not as formal as we are used to. By the time you get to A New Hope, this is, you know, people just getting fed up and starting to get together and organize in very loose loose manners. It was reasonably good. If I would give this one a 6. They introduced a lot of new characters, and I didn't feel that any of them got nearly enough time or development with it. I can't say either that they trode over a lot of new material. I really felt like a lot of it was pulling from books and comic books and other things over the years. There wasn't a lot of new original stuff. One of the main characters at the end turned out to be a Jedi. Surprise, surprise. It's
because you can't have anything Star Wars related that doesn't have at least one Jedi.
Yes, exactly. So as I said, it was somewhat predictable, and they put a few new twists and turns on things to keep it not a copy, but at the same time, there was nothing that would take any Star Wars fan by shock. The second one picked up a little bit. It was called Droids in Disguise, and we ended up getting to see did I miss one? Anyway.
No, you didn't. It was the first one counts as two.
The first one was like a movie-length thing.
Yeah, it was like an hour and a half or something long. Okay,
did anybody else catch this, by the way?
I've been catching it.
Okay, and what did you think of the first part?
I'd give the first one a 7. One of the main things the show is going for me, as far as is that it's set during one of the during a time period within the Star Wars universe that I always want to see more stories from, which is the quote unquote dark times, sort of a bit before the events of A New Hope, where you know, you've got the evil empire and you've got all these like fringy criminal elements running around, and you've got this fledgling rebellion and stuff like that. I always like, you know, when it comes to Star Wars EU and whatnot, I always like the stories that are get away from Jedi, like, you know, more of the rogues and scoundrels, or more of the rebels as these as this, you know, hard pressed resistance. I always like those kinds of stories, and I you know, this fits that bill really well. Even if it does have a Jedi, it's a Jedi in hiding. He makes that point very, very, you know, very early on, that he doesn't get all Jedi unless it's a really, really bad situation. And when he does so, it has some unintended consequences that the characters haven't really found out about yet. I thought it was really fun. I thought that it was Star Wars-y, but it had a vibe that reminded me a lot of the, you know, you know, they've got an old but you know, cool ship with a crew of you know, bickering crew members and stuff like that. Like, it was, they were very much going for as much the imitators of that original Millennium Falcon vibe, guys like, you know, Firefly or Guardians of the Galaxy or Farscape or whatnot, as they were for you know, the you know, original Millennium Falcon crew from the classic movies. And the other thing I'll say about the show that it really has going for it in the first season, at least, is that it's Greg Wiseman is heavily involved. He's the creator of Gargoyles and Spectacular Spider-Man, which are two, like, fantastic animated shows that just did such a good job of, like, character-driven storytelling that was kid-friendly but not dumbed down or anything like that. And I was very upset to learn that he's not going to be involved in the second season.
So let's see what. So Gary, why don't you go ahead then, and we can talk about the other one. So it was Droids in Disguise, I believe. What was the
name
for that?
Yes, episode 3, Droids in Disguise. The rebels intercept a shipment of weapons intended for the Empire and accidentally end up hosting a pair of droids.
Okay.
Yes, they waited till episode 2 for the cameo. I gave this one a 7.
Okay. Yeah, all right. That sounds fairly accurate to me. What about you, Bronstam? What did you think of this one?
I'm a bit tempted to go up to an 8, but I'd probably give it another 7. It was a lot like the first one. You know, bringing in those particular characters was not as big a plus. It was not enough of a plus for me to bump up the episode's mark, although it was kind of, you know, cool to see them. But, you know, it's more of the show just sort of like figuring out, you know, a bit of what it wants to be and whatnot. And, yeah, it's fun. It's enjoyable. It's not just a good Star Wars story. It's a good Star Wars story of the particular subtype that I really like.
Yeah. I liked the pilot quite a bit. I gave it an 8 myself. I wrote up a review over on VogNetwork.com to that effect. I wasn't so happy with this episode, but largely because I was a little annoyed that they had to go right to the well with the familiar droids.
Yeah.
That was it's a little bit of a show of lack of confidence, although I think part of it might have also been somebody pushing them to do that early in order to kind of link it together so that people had something familiar to grab onto. But yeah, those wouldn't have been my first choices when it came to established characters showing up. not at all. Let's see. But I still gave it a 7. I still think it was a fairly, you know, average episode, but it just didn't really do anything huge for me. It was kind of just picking up from the pilot, and I'm still waiting for the next big thing to happen.
You know, and we want to call that like a cameo or something like that, but at the last scene of the episode where Bail Organa actually comes out, you know, played by Jimmy Smits in the movies, and I guess he's supposed to be Leia's adoptive father. You know, he starts talking down to R2. Okay, now tell me everything that you saw about it. You know, it's definitely, you know, he's the sort of spark behind organizing the rebellion. And, you know, that was one little thing that was nice about the cameo, where it showed that, you know, it starts to make sense that somebody's got to sort of gather information and get this rebel group functioning at some point, and it looks like it's going to be him.
Yeah, that I didn't mind nearly as much. I thought that actually made a lot of sense to have that happen, and that's more of the kind of character that I would like to see be the focus rather than a droid, and particularly those, because I'm kind of tired of them. But that's just me. Edmund, if you don't mind kicking us off on the next few.
Sure. Next up, we've got The Good Wife. Season 6, Episode 3, Dear God. Carrie's pretrial service officer interviews his colleagues to determine whether or not he should be released from prison. Meanwhile, Alicia and Dean venture into unfamiliar territory when a client's case ends up in Christian arbitration. And
Henry gave this one an 8.5.
Okay. And then, Season 6, Episode 4, Oppo Research, Alicia explores the option of running for state's attorney to help her decide. Eli brings in a respected campaign manager. And yes, I was actually looking this up, and it looks to me like Henry gave this one a 10.
Yes, he did, amazingly enough. Yeah, so it looks like this season is maintaining the level of quality and that everybody was kind of hoping that it would. Let's see. I can take the next few, obviously. Resurrection, Season 2, Episode 2, Echoes. Bellamy and Sheriff Fred fear that Caleb may have returned to Arcadia when they hear reports that someone is living in his old hunting shack. At the same time, Bellamy struggles with the knowledge that he is one of the returned and has difficulty following the orders of his mysterious boss. Meanwhile, Janine tries to save her marriage to Pastor Tom by moving back home, and Margaret Langston is none too happy to learn what has become of the family business. And boy, is there a reason why she's not happy about that. I gave this one a 7.5, still better than the first season, but a little slow-paced regardless, but Michelle Fairley is bringing it as Margaret Langston, really adding a lot to the cast. Season 2, Episode 3, Multiple. Bellamy confides in Tom, explaining that he's one of the returned. At the same time, the pastor senses a need for a new parish, specifically for those who have come back to Arcadia. Elsewhere, Margaret seems determined to keep hidden whatever connection the Langston family has to old human bones that have mysteriously turned up in the river. And the interesting part about that is that the sets of human bones all ultimately turn out to be the same two people, meaning that they are returned that were serially killed one over and over and over again. And it turns out that these bones were previously buried on the site of the family business, which is perhaps why Margaret Langston is not too happy about any of this. So it points to the fact that not only is this whole resurrection thing happening in this one location, and it seems tied to this location, but it's happened before. Woo. So, again, 7.5. This show is a lot more interesting than it was in the first season. It's a lot darker, but it's still very slow-paced. All right. Next one is the original Season 2, Episode 1, Rebirth. Season 2 begins with Klaus plotting his revenge against the Guerrera werewolves and vowing to take down anyone who poses a threat to Baby Hope's existence. Meanwhile, Haley mourns the loss of her daughter and struggles to adapt to her new hybrid status. Marcel tries to rebuild his home. Cammy seeks comfort in a surprising place. And Davina tries to use Michael against Klaus, but gets sidetracked when she meets the mysterious yet charming Caleb, who holds a few secrets of his own. And there's also Season 2, Episode 2, Alive and Kicking. Klaus encourages Haley to regain her position within her werewolf pack. Michael tries to uncover a spell that will protect her loved ones. Davina and Caleb are threatened when unexpected visitors crash their dinner. Klaus grows suspicious when a meeting with Cassie doesn't go as planned. All that confusion kind of boils down to the fact that all of the disparate plot lines that really weren't working in the first season get wiped out by the season premiere, and a much better family-oriented conflict begins between those two episodes as well. Both of them I gave an 8. The spinoff is doing a lot better right now, story-wise, than the original. not surprising, as The Vampire Diaries is kind of getting long in the tooth.
Yeah.
Edmund, if you could go ahead with the last one here.
Absolutely. This was the season finale of, or finales of Legends. Two separate episodes, but they did broadcast them all on one night, so they did kind of run together. Season 1, Episode 9, Wilderness of Mirrors. Martin escapes from an interrogation and discovers that Sonya and Naden have been abducted. As he searches for them, Martin unearths more information about his past. I would give this a 7.5. And then
yeah, it sounds about right.
Yeah. And basically, I just want to run through the recaps and then discuss them together, because they did kind of just continue. Season 1, Episode 10, Identity. Martin learns that Varax may be plotting an assassination in the Season 1 finale. Also, Martin gets kidnapped and makes a shocking discovery about his own identity. I give this a 7, primarily because the shocking discovery was our Bond-esque villain having him tied up and telling him everything that had happened, which I thought was really, really silly.
I gave it a 7 as well, but less for the monologuing and more for the fact that the season kind of was wrapping up very nicely, and I'm guessing that they weren't entirely sure of a pickup, but one way or the other, it felt like they very quickly re-edited and redid some things at the end to make it really confusing.
Yes.
And things just kind of happen, and it's a real mess at the very end. And so it kind of flopped at the end a little bit. It didn't quite stick the landing. That said, it's kind of funny that between the two of us, we kept trading back and forth similar grades for the show. So between the two of us, we literally came within like a couple hundredths of a point of each other for the season. So it's kind of funny. But anyway, yeah, I mean, this – I was surprised by the fact that they actually struck right at the heart of this whole question of who Martin Odom is.
Mm-hmm.
And that for a show from the same people that made Homeland and 24 and so forth, it actually held together pretty well.
Yes, it did. Yeah, I mean, my main problem with the monologue, it was, okay, you've had this whole team of investigators and hackers, and, you know, not a huge team, but the fact that it all has to be the villain who reveals everything rather than, you know, them actually figuring at least some of it out themselves. for me, the actual ending, I mean, other than, you know, yes, just stealing the ending from the Parallax View was, you know, so yes, it is something that's 40 years old now.
What's that? Tried and true.
Exactly. But they did at least manage to bring it to a point where yes, we've gotten all these answers and they have a place to start for next season, if there is a next season.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Either one of you guys happen to pick this one up?
No.
It's not bad. It's especially for a kind of summer show that was not really promoted too much until maybe the last few weeks before it came out.
And for Sean Bean fans, yes, I've already given the spoiler warning. He doesn't die.
Well, yeah, that was the infamous promotion, was that he was going around with a sign basically saying, don't let them kill me, and things like that.
Yes.
it was rather amusing in that regard. There is one show I forgot to put on the list. I'll go ahead and cover it real quick because our friend Dean did review this for and it's up on vognetwork.com. American Horror Story Season 4, Episode 1, Monsters Among Us. Somewhat infamously, an episode that people are now terrified of clowns more than they ever have been before. Police make a grim discovery at a farmhouse in the Season 4 premiere. Again, it's almost like it's AMC again. Nadim loved this. He gave it a 9. I don't know if anyone else picked this up. I know that I pretty much gave up on this show, but
I had it on the DVR. I heard so much about Jessica Lange singing Life on Mars that I did just go and fast forward to that section.
That's made me want to watch it more than anything else I've heard about the show.
It's actually towards the end of the episode, and I watched a little bit after that, got a kind of sense of some of the things that were going on, and then got down my my box set of the BBC series Life on Mars and decided I'd rather watch that. So.
I don't blame you.
Make of that what you will.
I take great stock in it. Let's put it that way. I mean, the show kind of lost its shock factor for me a long time ago, but we'll see what Nadim has to say about it throughout the season, I suppose. All right, that is it for this week. Like I said, we still have quite a few things still left over for next time, but we got a good amount off of our list. And so it looks like we are definitely just jammed up with a lot of material for this fall season. Any last thoughts, gentlemen, for this week? How about Bronstone?
Wow, TV's really back.
Yeah, that's the only way to put it, right? Gary, any last thoughts?
Yeah, my DVR broke, so it's going to be heck keeping up with these shows, but I will bear on.
It actually broke.
Yes, yeah, my TiVo went.
That is what happens when you keep joking about your DVR screaming for mercy.
It said, I don't even, and jumped out the window.
Well, no, I reset it for all the new shows that are coming up, and it just I must have overwhelmed it.
It said, I can't even, and jumped into a patch of pumpkin spice.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Edmund, any last thoughts?
Yeah. Well, mine was also creaking under the load. That's why I was not up on Supernatural. But so far I've been saying kind words to it, and I seem to be able to nurse it along.
There you go. All right. Well, there's certainly still a lot of things that we are going to have to get to next time around, and it's all big stuff. And there will be more episodes of even the things we already talked about. So there you go. Packed fall season.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.